The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black.
More than 47 million people in the United States have been diagnosed with a mental illness. And that means that nationwide, almost one in five people are living with a mental health condition. Our guest on this episode, activist and author Sarah Fay, is one of those who've been diagnosed with a mental illness.
In fact, Sarah Fay has been diagnosed, or rather misdiagnosed, with six mental illnesses over the last 30 years. She writes about her experience and raises important mental health questions for all of us in the new book, Pathological, The True Story of Six Misdiagnoses. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell us why you decided to write this book, why you felt it was really necessary.
Well, as you mentioned, I was diagnosed with six different disorders, and it started when I was 12. So anorexia, generalized anxiety disorder, major depressive disorder, then ADHD, OCD, and then bipolar disorder. So I spent 25, 30 years in total in the mental health system, and I still wasn't getting well. And I couldn't understand, why have I been given six different diagnoses and still I'm not any better? And so when I was in crisis, actually, and I was without a psychiatrist and I was suicidal at the time. And my sister swept in. Anyone who's been through this knows that the families are the heroes of these stories. Certainly my family is the hero of mine. They've been amazing, but she swept in, she found me a psychiatrist and I went to see him and we had our 30-minute consultation. And at the end, I waited for him to give me a new diagnosis, a seventh one. This was when I was on my sixth, or to confirm the bipolar diagnosis. And he looked at me and he said, "I don't know what you have." And my whole world shifted. And I left his office. It was the dead of winter in Chicago, a polar vortex. And I just remember the city looked so crisp, but also harsher. But I felt like no one knows what I have. Wait a second. And I just realized I don't know anything about the diagnoses I've been given. I know nothing. I don't know where they come from. I don't know what they really are. I don't know how these doctors have determined that I have them. And so because I have a doctorate and I spent 6 years researching, I'm a bit of a research dork. So what I did was I just dove in and I started researching mental health diagnoses. I said, I'm going to learn everything about them. And I did. And it was disturbing and a lot of every day of nobody told me, nobody told me, told me over and over again.
You write in detail about what you call the psychiatrist's Bible, which is how psychiatrists base these diagnoses on. And it's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders and all of the flaws that it has. So what is the DSM and how is it so detrimental?
Yes. And if your eyes just glazed over, listeners, don't worry, mine did too. Like for some reason, those words, like diagnostic and statistical manual. But what's interesting is the DSM, whether you know it or not, that's what it's referred to as. Also, as you said, psychiatry's Bible is a huge part of our culture. So you know it, whether you know it or not, meaning, you know, we have diagnoses, the diagnoses that come from it. It's just a book. I didn't know this. It's a manual with pages and like any other book. And so all of our mental health diagnoses are in there. And just to give you a visual of what the book looks like, you have the diagnosis at the top of the page. So let's say major depressive disorder. And then there are symptom lists. So you have to qualify for the diagnosis by having 5 of 9 symptoms in the case of major depressive disorder. And so it's very orderly. And at face value, it looks okay. I mean, you wouldn't pick it up and question it. But what I learned in my research is that really the diagnoses are just theories. So I pictured it like physical illnesses. We discover an illness and then we theorize about it, let's say. So, but we can see it. We have an objective marker of it, meaning there's a blood test for major that shows you have major depressive disorder, or let me show you this brain scan, or let me show you this X-ray. We don't have any of that for the diagnoses in that book and the diagnoses that we receive. And then what I learned as well is Robert Spitzer, who is one of the main architects of modern psychiatry and the DSM, he was asked, why do you need 5 of 9 symptoms to receive a diagnosis of major depressive disorder? And he said, it was just arbitrary. We went around the table and 4 seemed like too few and 6 seemed like too many.
Oh, my God.
And that was, that's the same criteria we use today.
Really is different going to a medical doctor for a broken bone and they can see it on an X-ray and say, oh, you have a broken bone, or you have a blood test that tells them that you have an infection. And, yes. and that just doesn't exist for mental health issues.
Exactly. And, you know, in some ways, when we think about it, there's nothing wrong with that. Diagnoses are what we have. That's just what we have. It's what we've been dealt. Think about it. We've got a brain and a mind. What is even a mind? I mean, we don't even know what that is. So psychiatry is up against a lot. We've got to give them a little grace, you know, I mean, in the sense of they're trying to do something that essentially is almost impossible with what we have now and what we know. So there's nothing wrong with the fact that DSM diagnoses and mental health diagnoses are really what's called scientifically invalid, meaning you have no biological marker. Like you said, there's no blood test for them and they're unreliable, which means the symptom lists that we have don't always lead to consistent diagnoses, but among clinicians, but also for people, which is why you can receive 6 in your lifetime, perhaps. So none of that, there's nothing wrong with that. We have to use what we can. What I see and why, going back to your question, why I wrote the book was that I didn't know this. And as a patient, I feel entitled to that information. And I started to see all these people around me accepting mental health diagnoses without knowing it too. And that just seemed a real disservice to the public. I was actually on NPR recently with Paul Applebaum, who is chair of the steering committee of the DSM. So like the head of the DSM. And I wrote a book critiquing it. You know, I thought we were going to rumble or something, but he was wonderful. And Tom Insel was on there too. Another really prominent figure in psychiatry. And they both just agreed. Yes, the public deserves to know. And they deserve to know what psychiatry knows. And so that's really the gap I'm trying to fill with the book. So telling my story, which is a page turner, I hope, and then also giving people, I sprinkled in surreptitiously all the information you need to know about the DSM.
Because a lot of people just go from doctor to doctor if they don't like the diagnosis, right? I mean, is that a bad thing to do? It seems like it would be, but at the same time, if you're not fitting into one of these categories and you're not having any luck with psychiatric drugs, that makes sense.
Yes. And I do know what that's like. And that's why, you know, I don't want anyone to think two things. One, I always want to preface, mental illness is very, very real. And I'm not at all questioning that category. I had one and I know it's real. So that I just want to be clear. Questioning the DSM diagnoses are really about questioning the tools that we're using to tell you what's wrong or what, you know, by labeling people this or that. That's really what's being called into question, not mental illness. So I always want to just be clear about that. But what you bring up is the DSM, as I said, is such a huge part of our culture that sometimes we're actually going and requesting diagnoses. And that's something that never happened before.
Look at these symptoms online and say, oh, that's right. And lead the doctor into that diagnosis.
Yes, exactly. And without anything to prove or disprove it, then we're running into trouble. And then I think the other thing is doctors are as susceptible to that. So they are looking for diagnoses too. And this is my book, why I think it's so important for people is that it represents what a lot of people right now are going through, and not the typical mental illness memoir tends to be about psychiatry and anti-psychiatry and very much, you know, about these extreme experiences. My experience became extreme, but I really stumbled into the mental health system in some ways. And I think a lot of people do, looking for an answer and looking for help. And then the other part of my story that's more like what a lot of people are going through is that five of my six diagnoses came from GPs, from general practitioners, just family doctor. Oh. I can't blame psychiatry for what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And what I learned in my research, which is shocking, is that actually GPs are doing most of the diagnosing and prescribing. They prescribe 80% of antidepressants. And they prescribe.
I had no idea. Yeah. I never would have thought that they did yeah. really any of them. I would think that would be a referral.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but nobody told me. I mean, it's just like over and over again. And then they prescribe 50% of antipsychotics to children. So you've got this. And then what gets more disturbing, and again, I don't want to, you know, I think that this is disturbing, but also a great opportunity, is that in a University of Michigan study from 2019, they found that only 24%, so less than a quarter of medical schools, offer GPs more than 12 hours of psychiatric training. That's all they have. That's it. I mean, like, let that sink in. That's a season of Grey's Anatomy. You know, like, what are we, you know, and wow. there, but then what's also even more disturbing is they asked those same doctors, do you feel comfortable diagnosing patients with psychiatric disorders? And the majority of them said, very comfortable. So wow. there's a real problem there, which I think is very fixable, which is nice in the sense of, and I'm being blithe about this. I teach at a university, so I know how hard it is to change curriculum, but change the curriculum, train our GPs. I mean, they're there for a reason and they're given that privilege of diagnosing for a reason, which is that a lot of us don't have access to psychiatrists. And so it's about access to care. So it comes from a good place, but we really need to change that and make sure that they're being trained. Or that the other thing I really recommend for people is if you are diagnosed by a GP, see a psychiatrist if you can. Again, I know that's a luxury, but the other thing is ask your psychiatrist to confirm the diagnosis. Your GP to confirm the diagnosis with a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. That can happen.
Now, what happened in your story after you had these six misdiagnoses and you went to the seventh doctor who said, I don't know what you have. Then what happened in your story?
Well, then it's kind of fascinating. So he never told me what I had, and I never asked again. He did tell me that he's changed it two more times. So I don't know what number we're on, but I've never asked. So I still have a diagnosis. I am still on medication. I still see him. He's still my psychiatrist. He's very open with me about the flaws in mental health diagnoses. We talk about it. He knows he's in the book. He's okay with being in the book. I don't know if he's going to read the book. I don't know, but I think he comes off looking pretty good. So I told him that, but he, you know, so I have never asked for it because what happened to me, and not everyone does this, but I think I've heard from a lot of readers who have, which is that I over-identified with my diagnosis. I really became it, each one. So I really could see myself in the diagnosis. And there's a good reason for that. Our diagnoses, our mental health diagnoses, the symptoms of them are all things that are a part of daily life, depression, anxiety, you know, so they're just part of being alive with the exception of maybe psychosis and a couple of other things. But so it's very easy to see yourself in any diagnosis, not everybody, but if you're slightly, you know, hardwired, like I am a sensitive creature, you know, which is how I see myself. But so that, you know, you're going to see yourself in the diagnosis. And I certainly did. And that also came from a place, it's not faking it. I mean, I want to be very clear. I was never faking, but when you do over-identify, what happened is it became my whole life. And every emotion, every thought, every behavior I attributed to my diagnosis. So if I was sad, unexplainably sad, one day it was my depression. That was my depression, like I owned it. And now that I don't have a diagnosis, when I wake up sad, which happens unexplainably, nothing's wrong, but I'm terribly sad. I have to wrestle with that now. And I can't just say it's my depression. It kind of forces me to really feel my emotions and allow them to be in my life and to look at my thoughts, but also to look at my circumstances and say, okay, am I working too much? Is there something that might be pushing me to feel this way? Am I not listening to myself or, you know, something along those lines? So it's been very beneficial for me not to have a diagnosis. And I said to my family for you know, I've been saying this for a couple of years. I said, I think I'm well. I mean, I don't think well. I mean, I think I'm cured. And my family said, yeah, I know. I think you are too. Uh-huh. And so, because there's this, I mean, I live in a different mind right now. And so I'm writing the sequel to Pathological, which is about how I healed and how, you know, that recovery from mental illness. And I don't like that word, but people have been hesitant to say, you know, that you can be cured. There isn't a cure, meaning the noun. There isn't a pill we can take. There isn't one practice of meditation that we can do that will cure mental illness. But I believe that going through certain processes and doing certain things, and maybe not necessarily the way I did, it might be individual for each person, I am cured. And then I didn't feel comfortable saying that, and certainly not writing it in a book, but Thomas Insull, who was former head of the NIMH, he just came out with a book, a wonderful book called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. And he has said, mental illness is not chronic. We need to start giving people hope and letting them know that they can heal. So now I'm all with Tom.
We love having you as part of our Nobody Told Me family of listeners. We know a lot of you want to be your own boss or already operate your own business. That's why we want you to know about Shopify.
Hear that? That's the sound of another sale on Shopify and the moment another business dream becomes reality.
Shopify puts you in control of every sale channel. So whether you're selling satin sheets from Shopify's in-person POS system or offering organic olive oil on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you're covered.
Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform that's revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle.
And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers.
Once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere.
What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level.
Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 170 countries.
Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/nobody, all lowercase.
Go to shopify.com/nobody to take your business to the next level today.
Shopify.com/nobody.
I think as a society, we're not really doing a service by whether or not we're trying to do it by saying, like, with a celebrity, I don't know, Pete Davidson, for example, okay, he's depressed. And so whenever I think about him, it's absolutely no judgment, but it's just something that I think about. And I know even, you know, when my mom and I are having conversations, it's like, oh yeah, he's depressed. He's depressed or something. So do you think that that's not a good thing, and that's making it so that people are kind of afraid of, you know, coming out and telling the world what they have because they don't want to be like Pete Davidson or any celebrity.
He may not be depressed now that he's with Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, that's true. He may be cured now.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe it's Kim Kardashian is the cure. I don't know. It's interesting that you bring that up. I'm actually finishing up an op-ed, an opinion essay on this, and how mental health awareness has backfired. It comes from a great place. I mean, Mental Health Awareness Month, which is May, you know, that started in 1949. It's been around, and the point of it is wonderful to educate people about mental health and diagnoses and mental illness, and to eliminate stigma. There's nothing wrong with that. But what's happened is the focus of all of our discussions about mental health have become centered on diagnoses. Like that's the starting point and the end point, and there's nothing else there. Even when we talk about other aspects of mental health, it's in terms of diagnoses. And it's gotten to the point where we've confused depression, the emotion, with depression, the disorder, and anxiety, the emotion, with anxiety, the disorder. And we use the terms interchangeably. So I think that, and then you've got, they're all over social media. People are self-diagnosing on social media. We have TikTok therapists. And then, as you said, celebrities come out. And one scholar wrote about essentially how young people will look at a celebrity, you know, who's talking about a mental health diagnosis and say, oh, if they have it, maybe I have it too, in this kind of idolizing way. So there can be backfire there as well. It's tricky. I mean, we can talk about, is awareness of a diagnosis a good thing, or is it actually making us identify with them? And then, you know, it has been reported that people are asking for diagnoses, and that never happened. But what's interesting is I was in the 19th century, people didn't know their diagnoses. And this was true actually pre-1960s. So it was just for doctors. Actually, the DSM was simply for doctors to communicate with each other. It was never meant. These diagnoses were never meant for us, ever.
Wow.
And so for us to be identifying with them, that's, you know, that's not what they were for. They're just, so my doctor has my diagnosis and he can communicate with anyone. And I'm just living in the 19th century and everyone else can live here. I don't know.
Yeah. And don't you also think that maybe the prospect of getting a diagnosis and a label may prevent some people from actually seeking help because they don't want to be called whatever it might be that they have a negative association with.
That's such a good point. And what's interesting about that is I read part of my research was that you would think the biological explanation for mental health diagnoses, which by the way, I didn't know, no one told me that that's never been proven. There is no such thing as a chemical imbalance. That was debunked 20 years ago.
Wow.
Oh, I had no idea.
Nobody talks about that.
Yeah.
No. So what, you know, those aspects of this that are not being talked about, but what they found as well is that they thought, oh, the biological explanation is good. It may not be proven yet, but it's going to be, is what they've promised for 20 years, but it hasn't been. But the biological explanation prevents people from self-stigmatizing. Right? That's the idea. Because if you think, well, it's not a character flaw, it's not something wrong with me. But what they found is actually it leads to more self-stigma because then it's in you. It's you. It's like your biology instead of something you could possibly transcend or heal from or move past.
What advice do you have for somebody who has recently been diagnosed with a mental health disorder and feels really shattered and a sense of shame because of it?
I understand that. I think the most shame I felt was with bipolar disorder, certainly. So I understand that. And I was shocked to get that diagnosis. I didn't think, I mean, it shouldn't have come as a shock because I received it while I was in crisis, but it really did. And I didn't want it. But then what happened to me was I clung to it. So it was almost like, oh, this has to be the answer. This has to be, you know, where I'm going to find the key to my mental health. So I would just say it can be great to identify with a diagnosis. So a good example of this is autism. Uh-huh. That community, I mean, they just rally. They rally around each other. They get services for themselves. They get funding. I mean, they're amazing. That's a very positive diagnosis and where I see diagnosis working really well. I mean, there are some issues with it, but, you know, for the most part, it's a good example of that. The issue with me was I identified with all the negatives. So I was really holding myself back. And that's what I encourage people not to do. If it offers some sort of relief, the diagnosis, that's great. You know, that's wonderful. And I have very close friends for whom that's true. And I support them 100%. Definitely don't want to take anyone's diagnosis away. I'm not medically trained to do that for one thing, but so yeah, to just not necessarily, not to take on all the negatives as being a part of you. I mean, there are other things that worked well for me, but that's not really advice that I could give anyone else. But the one thing, of course, is if you get a diagnosis from a GP, please ask for a second opinion.
What are some of the concerns that you have in terms of people and the pandemic and the mental health issues that they may be feeling as a result of the pandemic that may not be a specific mental illness?
Yeah. I mean, where I see that, and this is all over the media, and I'm sure you've seen it too, is mental health crisis among teens. And I think that what's being a little bit left out, first of all, what people are doing is trying to find the reason. And I feel like we were in a global pandemic and they were in their rooms for 2 years. I hope they, I mean, if they weren't feeling anxiety and depression, we'd worry about them. We'd call them sociopaths. You know? So it's kind of, I mean, I think that it's not to say that there isn't something wrong. Like, just like with me, there was something wrong. What I worry about is someone who is in a similar position to what I was in. When you receive a diagnosis at 12 and you identify with that diagnosis and you start to see, I mean, what happened to me was I was, as I said, 12 and my parents were divorcing and I was going to a new high school. I was terribly sad and I was terrified and I had a stomach ache and I wasn't eating. And it was extreme. I was not eating, but I wasn't counting calories and I wasn't weighing myself and I didn't think I was fat, which are kind of the cornerstones of the anorexia diagnosis. But we went to my pediatrician and he said, "You have anorexia." And so I, from then on, associated stomachache, sadness, terror with a diagnosis. So I started to associate my emotions and my thoughts and my behaviors with a diagnosis instead of just letting them be there as part of my life and as everything in my life. So I worry about during the pandemic, so many young people receiving diagnoses without being told that these diagnoses are approximations and may or may not, you know, be totally what we think they are.
And since the medical field has such focus on these diagnoses, it makes me nervous that you might have people kind of doing the opposite of saying they have the symptoms that make up the disorder that they think they have. And they may just say, "Oh my God, I don't want to be bipolar. Uh-huh. I don't want to be psychotic or something like that." And maybe don't say what they're actually feeling because they don't want to have that disorder. And they know the questions that the doctors would ask to test that.
Where this gets also really confusing is there are now acceptable diagnoses and unacceptable ones, even cool diagnoses and uncool. So the accepted ones are ADHD and depression and anxiety and phobias. Those are okay. But bipolar, no. Borderline personality disorder, no. And schizophrenia, no. So you've got this kind of subculture of diagnosis where what if you had a child who's suffering from, you know, schizophrenia, but that's not a cool diagnosis. I mean, it's really, you know, kind of getting into a place where, it's confusing.
What are some of the things that worked for you? Some of the things that you were able to do on your own without medication that helped you feel better mentally?
There are a lot of the things I'm about to say are going to feel like, really? That's kind of dorky. And it is, they are. So I just want to preface that. Okay. One thing that I do is every morning, and this was something I started once I stopped identifying with the diagnosis, is I just write down all my thoughts. So just one after another in a list, just after another. They are incredibly negative, astoundingly negative. My favorite one is everything's wrong. Like, what is that? I don't even know how to deal with that, like how to confront it. But after a while, and I started reading a lot about evolutionary psychiatry, and I came to understand that our brains are designed to keep us alive. That's it. not to make us happy, not to make us calm. They are just there to keep us alive. And the way they do that often is to alert us of danger everywhere, all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think people like me, I mean, I still have deep waves of depression and crippling anxiety. So it's not as if things have changed that much in the sense of, I mean, it has changed, but those emotions are still there. Those experiences are still there. But knowing that my brain is really negative because it's trying to protect me has really changed everything. I hope that doesn't sound too meta or like weird, that these negative thoughts that I have, I get them out, I put them on a piece of paper and I throw them away. Like that's just, okay, we're done with those. Uh-huh. And now we're going to go about our day. And so I don't even look back at them. It's just a way to get it out. And this will sound, a little bit woo-woo or spooky, but I feel like, okay, my brain needs to be heard. Like I'm alerting you to all this danger. I'm letting it be heard. And now we're moving on. So that's been, I mean, it sounds, and I'll do it in the middle of the day too, if I notice that my anxiety is at a pitch or something like that. So that's been incredibly helpful. And then a weird thing, I never thought of the physical aspects of mental health in the sense of when I am struggling. So let's say I'm suddenly feeling overcome with sadness. Drink a glass of water. We're 60% water. Like that's contributing. That's like taking one for the, like giving back to the team kind of. And so I just drink a glass of water and sometimes it helps amazingly well. I mean, it doesn't solve any problems, but it's weird how those two things have become a kind of cornerstone of my life.
I think those are really great pieces of advice. Yeah. I think that anybody could try and use those, and those aren't really talked about, but they make so much sense.
And they're very inexpensive.
They're free. I mean, well, it's cheaper than the water.
Yeah, I love that.
At the end of each show, we always ask our guests, what is your nobody told me lesson? So what do you wish that someone had told you prior to embarking on your own mental health journey that you had to learn the hard way and you'd like to pass on to someone else who's maybe about to start seeking help for their own mental health?
The one thing that I would wish I'd known and that I would love to give to everyone as a gift is that recovery is possible and mental illness has not been proven to be chronic. Like that would have changed a lot for me is to know. I mean, I was told all of my diagnoses were chronic. I was told I'd have them for the rest of my life. And I just wish someone had said, no, you could recover from this. And here's what we're going to do. And maybe take you off medication or maybe not, or, whatever it is. And I just wish I'd had that option and that in mind.
And Sarah, how can people connect with you on social media and on the internet and learn more about your work?
So I'm at sarahfay.org, sarahfay.org. And I'm Sarah Fay author, all one word, sarahfay author at Sarah Fay author on all socials.
Great, great. Well, Sarah, this has been just so eye-opening and fun too, to talk with you. I mean, you're so honest.
You never think with mental health that would be a positive show, but my God, I feel really hopeful.
I was going to say, I feel better after talking with you. I feel better for the world.
Yeah.
Good. Because I do too. I mean, I can't tell you how hopeful I'm writing a sequel and to Pathological. And I just feel so hopeful, especially about that and giving that to people. I mean, we're all in this together. We just are.
Right.
And so,
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, our thanks to Sarah Fay, whose new book is called Pathological, The True Story of 6 Misdiagnoses. And again, her website is sarahfay.org. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.